So on this retreat, we have been talking, exploring the Four Noble Truths. And the last of the Noble Truths is the Eightfold Path. And Andrea began discussion of the Eightfold Path yesterday and leaves me today to talk about the middle section of the Eightfold Path. It's often called the Sila, or the ethics virtue section of right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And it's relatively, maybe hopefully it's easy to see the value of ethics in living a wise life. A life that doesn't cause harm to ourselves and others, a life that keeps us out of trouble. And even if you understood them as a code of rules that you live your life by, chances are that it would support you and help live a wise or safer life. But these ethical teachings or ethical aspects of the path are much deeper than rules or guidelines even. Because guidelines and rules can be seen as something outside of oneself, whereas the whole Eightfold Path is something that is not meant to be external, but something internal. It's meant to be something that we become. It's said, the Buddha said, that when someone is fully matured in the practice, they become the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path becomes an expression of something very deep and very beautiful within ourselves. And it's not a matter of putting something on, but rather it's really an aspect of giving expression or giving life to something that is very intimate, integral to who we are. And to give you a little sense of the depth of the Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths, the ethics part of it, how it's so beautiful, something to love and cherish, is to back up a little bit and discuss a look at the word dharma. Dhamma. One of the conventional meanings of dharma is the teachings of the Buddha. In that sense, it's a little bit, you get these old books and can read the teachings of the Buddha. You can stay up late translating them if you want. But that's really the meaning of dharma. The core meaning of dharma. The way that the core kind of the depth or the profundity of what this word dharma means is probably conveyed a little bit. You get the sense of a little bit if you see that the word dharma has the same importance in a Buddhist life as the word God would have in a theistic life. And God is a very important concept for theists. And dharma, even though dharma is a very different concept, it has the same value. And some people in some ways relate to dharma in some similar ways in terms of a primary orientation that they have for their life or value or something very sacred and special. But it's a mistake to think that dharma is something outside of you. So one of the ancient ways that the word dharma, the concept of dharma is described or characterized is that it's the earliest record, it's interesting, we have the earliest record we have of Buddhism being taught to someone from the Western culture. It was a text called the Milindapana, ancient text. And in there, this Greek king is told that the characteristic of the Dharma, what characterizes the Dharma, is non-harming. So that's the primary characteristic of the Dharma is that is non-harming. Now what's interesting about that is that non-harming is inseparable from a person who is not harming. It's people who, you know, it's referring to people who don't harm. So, you know, it isn't like, you know, that some external thing that doesn't harm. It's Dharma's pointing to a characteristic that we can have that's within us. So, and the Dharma is not a thing. You can't point to the Dharma, even though it's one of the most profound things that we can have in our lives. We can take refuge in, we can protect, we're protected by, we're supported by. And in fact, one of the ancient, again, definitions of Dharma is that Dharma is that which upholds us or supports us. And it also says it protects us, it liberates us. So I think it's interesting to compare it to floating on water. When you're floating on water, the water supports you, it holds you up. We say that. But it's not really the water that supports you and holds you up, because if you don't know how to swim, it's not going to hold you up. If you don't know how to float, you know, you're going to drown. It's deadly. The water's deadly. Throw you into the ocean and you don't know how to swim and that's it. So it's not the water that supports you. And it's not something innate in you. It isn't like in your innate goodness, your Buddha nature. I'm going to trust my Buddha nature, my innate goodness. If you don't know how to swim and you throw into the ocean, you'll still drown. But if you learn the skill of swimming, of floating, if you learn that capacity, then together, the water, your body, and your skill together, you can relax in a certain way. And you're held up by we say we're held by the water. It supports the water. But it's not the water that supports us. It's this combination of all three. It's the way these things function together, the relationship, how we learn to harmonize the relationship with all three, how they get them to work together in this useful, beneficial way. With this analogy, the Dharma is not the water. The Dharma is not you or the essence of who you are. The Dharma is in that wonderful interaction, that harmony that's found by all three. It's not separate from who you are, but it's also, you can't take it too personally either, because it's not you. It's, you know, it's the water, it's the whole system that does it. So the Dharma of the Buddha, the Dharma of this practice here, is not something that's innate, but it's certainly a potential within us, and it really is found, in a sense, within us, in a transformation, in a skill, in understanding, that's quite profound and beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful things a human being can do. But it's not foreign from, it's not innate and it's not foreign. It's kind of like there's this mutuality, wonderful interrelatedness that is found with the world, with ourselves, with this potential that we have. And that wonderful interrelatedness and the finding of harmony, how it all works together, is the Dharma. And if we learn that Dharma, if we study that Dharma, that Dharma will support us. Will help us to float, keep us safe. But that Dharma, and this is the point I'm trying to drive home here, is inseparable, is not innate, but it's inseparable from us. It's inseparable from an inner transformation and change that we undertake. It's a lot about how we are. It's not about just simply understanding something. It's not about simply adopting some practices that seem like good practices to do. But rather, it's somehow being changed in the how we are, so that we, our lives are not that we know how to live in harmony, but we live in harmony. It just kind of comes out of us. It's kind of the way we are in the world. So to take refuge in the Dharma, in a sense, is take refuge in yourself, but not really just yourself. It's not so personal. It's not transpersonal because it's not beyond yourself. It's not extra personal, it's not outside of yourself. And this kind of points a little bit to the issue of human nature. What's our nature? And I read recently that there was a dramatic shift in the Western culture that began with the philosophy of Thomas Hobbes, where he lived in the 1700s, 1600s. Where he argued that there was really no inner goodness in human beings, but that we have a competitive nature, and that he has an expression apparently, it's a war, everyone against everyone else. And that in order to kind of live a harmonious social life, there has to be a social contract that keeps all these violent and possessive and greedy tendencies of human beings from going out of control. The idea of the, you know, everyone's, you know, that are, you know, we're all kind of, there's this evil or bad or nature that we have that has to be kept under control or something. And this was a big shift in the Western culture to kind of look at that way. And then there are people who argue that human nature is innately beautiful or divine. Some Western Buddhist teachings of Buddha nature point to this idea that there's something innate within us. And then in that mix, as we look at a kind of our human nature, try to understand what it is, I'm very interested in what they find, you know, modern scientists of human nature, what they're finding as they study evolution and physiology and different things. And one of the well-known physiological reactions that are deeply embedded in how our physiology works, psychophysiology works, is called fight or flight. And under threat, there's this wonderful mechanism. Breathing speeds up, gets shallower, your body tenses up, and the heart begins to race. All these things in preparation for these big, important activities of running or away or fighting. Somehow over evolutionary time, human beings have developed to have that capacity. But then now they've started to recognize a whole other capacity that's the opposite of fight and flight. And this is called approach and soothe. Approach and soothe. And approach and soothe also has the same kind of comparable kind of physiological changes in the whole system. That when a parent's going to approach and soothe a crying baby, that the breathing quiets down, the heart rates get slower, oxytocin's released into the system, there's a feeling of well-being and calmness that sets in. There's a whole physiological kind of mechanism that gets triggered that supports and aids in this whole idea of cooperation, of empathy, of support and caring for each other. And that we have built within us a system that has empathy in its genes, the capacity for empathy. So which of these operates in us? Is it fight or flight, or is it approach and soothe? And it depends a lot on how we understand threat, danger, safety, what's being threatened. If if it's the lion that's going to pounce on us, fight or flight makes some sense. But if it's I wonder what everybody's thinking about how much supper I'm putting on my plate. All these people are going to judge me. And then there's all this fear that arises, or all this, rebelliousness. Is that really a reasonable fear? What happens if we understand, what happens if we don't feel a sense of threat? If we don't feel a sense of threat, then I think that we're open towards receiving other information from the environment than we would if we had fight or flight. Some people go around living their whole life tense, afraid, angry. And it becomes a veil or a filter through which only some of what happens in the world is received. And if that veil and filter is relaxed, then other things are taken in. And one of the things that can be taken in is, empathy. We can feel profound empathy with other people. Empathy in many different ways. The empathy that gives birth to compassion, the empathy that gives birth to sympathetic joy and delight, to love, to appreciation. And one of the, things that happens with Dharma practice, I hope it happens, is we begin questioning and reassessing how threatenable we are. And maybe realizing that there's a lot less threat than maybe we've imagined. There's a lot less reason to be defensive, to be aggressive, to feel fear. A lot of what we are afraid of maybe is imaginary. Or maybe a lot of what we're afraid of at the essence can't really touch the depth of our hearts. I'm kind of fond of the fact that the word integrity, it's a beautiful word. People love the word integrity. And the Latin meaning of it means I can't be touched. Is there some part of you, some freedom, some beauty, that maybe can't really be touched, though it can be shared, that's safe? If we stay relaxed. And the Four Noble Truths point to this, because the Four Noble Truths point to the fact that the way that we're really not safe, ultimately, is from what we do to ourselves, how we react and respond to what goes on. And that's really the ultimate threat is from ourselves. The clinging, the grasping, and all the different forms. And as we learn to get a handle of that and learn how to identify the Four Noble Truths, how to identify suffering, stop for suffering, identify the clinging, let go of the clinging, we make ourselves safer for ourselves. So what acts through us, how we're capable of acting in the world or responding to the world or being in the world, has a lot to do with the conditions that we set around our hearts. If we set fear around it or aggression around it, then the heart responds a certain way. We respond a certain way in the world. But if we relax the fear, relax the aggression, relax the ambition, and let just relaxing, settling. Relaxation, you feel, when people are relaxed, they feel safe. When they're safe, they feel relaxed. Then there's a whole other way of responding to the world that probably is much more closely akin to the response that our approach and soothe. Of empathy. And this empathy that we respond is not a choice. It's not like, oh, it's a good idea to have compassion. I better figure out how to be compassionate. But it just kind of, it's how we are. It's not who we are, it's how we are. It just comes from us. And it's when I began understanding this that I began having a really profound appreciation for sila, for ethics in Buddhism. How the ethics is much more than rules, but it's a welling up, it's a way of being that it comes from being free. It comes from being settled, being relaxed, being sensitive in a deep way. And that the perspective that I have now for ethics, to sila, the different kind of ethical guidelines and all that, is not that they are supporting the development of practice for something in the future, creating the good conditions so I can practice deeply or something, creating good conditions for a better future, but rather the precepts, for example, are like mirrors to remind me that when I'm about to cross over those boundaries, that the chances are pretty good that I have lost touch with the inner freedom. I've lost touch with the Dharma. I've lost touch with this inner sense of safety or well-being. And so then it's a reminder, oh, remember, you've lost touch with something. Can I get back in touch with it? And if I'm in touch with it, then of course I'll act ethically. It's not a should, it's just what is. Ethical works both ways. It's really a profound topic. It works as a protection. It works as a way of supporting us. It works as building up momentum. One of the ways of developing mindfulness is to live by the precepts, for example. And you have to be mindful to live by the precepts. You have to be mindful to have right speech. And so they are very supportive in developing the practice. But there's a whole other side, that the ethics is not something is really an expression of something that is deep and profound and significant, very meaningful in ourselves. So And then before I kind of mention what these three steps are, I want to again reemphasize this idea that someone spiritually mature becomes the Eightfold Path, becomes the precepts, becomes right speech. It isn't that they take it on like a clothes that they wear, it becomes who they are. The word for the noble truths in Pali is Arya Satya. And it's quite appropriate with the grammar of those two words, to translate it as noble truths. However, the Pali grammar allows other translations, other meanings besides noble truths. And the one that the tradition prefers is not noble truths, but is the truth of the noble ones. That the four noble truths are the four truths of the noble ones. Noble ones of those who are spiritually mature. This is how they see the world. This is how they understand the world. This is the truth they become. And so the noble eightfold path is the eightfold path of the noble ones. So rather than a path of cultivation that we're going to cultivate to get spiritually mature, it's the path that's walked when you are spiritually mature. What's an enlightened person like? Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. That's a good answer. So, the first of the silas, Eightfold Path, is right speech. And being careful with how you speak, or being attentive to how you speak, is a very, very helpful process. I found that mindfulness speaking was one of the most difficult places for me to develop mindfulness in. But it's also one of the most productive, because if you are mindful of what you're going to say when you're going to say it, you start understanding what motivates you to say what you do. And our speech acts are generally motivated acts. We're trying to accomplish something. We're trying to do something. It's a purpose for our speaking. And to ask, what's that purpose? What's the intention behind the speech act? If you only did that as your spiritual practice, understood why you're going to say what you're about to say, it would take you really far. You'd understand a lot about yourself. It's amazing how people are so addicted to their speaking that they don't even, they lose themselves. I've talked to people where, none of you, please. but I've been talking to people, and you know, and they're talking away at me, with great passion about something, and there's this look in their eyes as they talk where they're kind of like they're out of touch. It's not like, kind of like the look of an addict. It's really something to see. And but just so you don't think that I don't do that. I remember once talking to one of my Zen teachers about something about practice. In the middle of my going on and on, he looked at me and he said, "Gil, talking to you is like talking to an addict." I was just like in this kind of world. And then what is it that we can notice? What is useful to notice in how we speak? It's very useful to notice, like I said, the motivation for what we speak, what we're speaking, the quality of what we speak, and the impact that our speech has. So one of the important things is our speech truthful? To question them, look, what I'm about to say, is it going to be truthful? Or is it a lie? Is it not really true? That which is most profound in us, the Dharma in us, wants to be truthful. Truthfulness is a characteristic, it's what it does. To speak what's not true goes against the grain of this depth thing. It also creates harm. It creates a much more complicated life. Chances are is that it reinforces tendencies we have, emotions we have, reactions we have, that we don't really want to live with. Reinforces the fight and flight, or the defensiveness, or aggression, or something else. It's a beautiful thing to be motivated to want to speak the truth, even if you don't, even if you're not successful. The fact that you want to, that's to be celebrated. If that's really are rooted in that motivation, in time it'll work itself out, whatever the tendencies you have to slip around the truth here and there. Right speech also entails avoiding divisive speech. Again, speech which causes harm in our community, dividing people against each other. Sometimes it's called slander. What motivates slander? What motivates divisive speech? Where inside of us, what part of our nature is being activated when we're involved in slander or divisive speech? Is it that side that belongs more to, fight or flight or aggression? Or it's probably not the side that's devoted more towards empathy and approach and soothe or care to kindness. Certainly, divisive speech and slander can cause a lot of harm. And so it's well worth being careful. But it's a matter of what do you want to feed? What do you want to develop and cultivate in yourself? So to look, to study, what's this, what I'm about to say now? What effect will it have in the world around me? And use that as a mirror. And then there's avoiding harsh speech. Harsh speech, what motivates that? Where does that come from? It might not be divisive, it might be true, but it has a kind of a violent quality to it in the voice, and it possible to have, the voice speak, not be harsh, but be kind? To have, and then the last one is not to have idle speech. That leaves everything out, right? But idle speech, I don't really know exactly what idle speech is, but idle speech is speech which really serves no useful purpose. Sometimes there's light chatter about, the weather or something that can seem idle, but it's actually allowing for a significant connection between two people. That's the vehicle for making a connection with someone. But just to talk for the purpose of talking, to talk for the purposes of avoiding our discomfort with silence, to talk to avoid what's really happening in the relationship or in our life, to chatter away as a way of, what is our speech about? It's a beautiful and profound and significant way in which our life force, our vitality, our conditioning, the way we're conditioned, the way we're shaped, manifests. And to care for our speech, to lovingly care for it, as if it's something to cherish and value, is part of the Eightfold Path. And then there's a right action, which is usually defined as the precepts, the five precepts. And the usual way in which the precepts are worded in the simplest formulation is as abstinences. We abstain from killing, stealing, lying, sexual misconduct, and intoxicants. But since the time of the Buddha, there's also been a positive understanding of what these precepts are. That living, not taking life, is to live with compassion for life. To live with without stealing is to live with generosity. To live without sexual misconduct is to live with contentment. To live with without lying is to live with the truth. And to live without intoxicants is to live with mindfulness, with clarity, to cultivate that side of us. I've never really been that interested in the precepts as morality or moral rules, thou shalt live this way, or you're a bad person. But I'm very interested in them as something that's liberating and freeing, something that expresses, something that is hopefully of great value. Something hopefully that we've learned to love and cherish, take refuge in, value. That they're closely connected to what's the greatest good for ourselves, to that Dharma that we are. And the precepts are something to be loved more than obeyed. And then the last of the three ethical steps in the Eightfold Path is right livelihood, ajiva. It's usually called livelihood. It's how we normally occupy ourselves in the ongoing support of our life, the ongoing caretaking of living a life. So for some people it's in paid work. For some people it's like a Buddhist monastic, they don't get paid, it's just their work, their livelihood is being a monastic. For some it's being a housekeeper, you know, like a stay-at-home wife or stay-at-home husband. That's their livelihood, that's their ajiva. And most people spend most of their time caring for their life, supporting their life in some way. Even if people are retired, have an ajiva, have a livelihood, because usually you have to cook and you have to clean your clothes and you have to do a lot of things, ongoing upkeep of the life, making the life possible. For people who have careers, or children, it's a huge part of their day. Biggest part of their waking life has connected to livelihood. And so it's because it's so important and so profound, has such a big impact on ourselves and the world around us, it has a very important role in the spiritual path. So what do we do at work? What do we do when we engage in our livelihood? Do we see it as part of the path? Do we find the Dharma there, the practice there? Work is not practice. I'll get to the practice when I get home and go to my cushion. That's a tremendous loss, because if you work 8 hours a day, that's a big chunk of time that's lost to practice if you don't engage it as a practice. So part of right livelihood is to consider, how is it I can practice here? What does it mean in this particular settings? I've had enough different kinds of jobs in my life to realize that different jobs call for different kinds of practices within them. And it's kind of fascinating to do different things, to see how. And since livelihood has a big impact on the world, is a livelihood we're living one that has a beneficial or harmful impact on the world? And if it's harmful, it actually harms you as well. It'll come back. If it's beneficial, it'll come back and benefit you. What is it you want your life to be about? How is it you want to be motivated in this world? What motivations inside of you do you want to feed? What sides of you do you want to give precedence to? And if you do work that's causing harm in the world, then perhaps it's not the work for you to do. And I've known people who've given up their work when they started Buddhist practice because it didn't make any sense for what they were trying to, how they're trying to live their life anymore. I remember many, many years ago now, a person came to I was sitting in on interviews with Christopher Titmus was doing interviews with someone, and this person said, in my line of work, I'm expected to lie. How can I lie and be a Buddhist at the same time? And he really expected a practical answer how to do that. And Christopher said, you can't do it. So somehow to find how livelihood can support you in doing that practice, and more profoundly, how livelihood can be an expression of the Dharma, expression of your Dharma, expression of something profound that you've discovered here. The Dharma is not just words and concepts, ideas, practices to be done. It is a kind of radiance of your heart. It's a kind of outflowing. It's a kind of presence that saturates and permeates us, the world, each other. It upholds us, it supports us, just as we support it with our practice, our dedication. So to finish this talk, and also I guess the series on the Four Noble Truths, I would like to offer you what I think is an amazingly, maybe ridiculously, simple description what the Four Noble Truths are about. Remember when I gave my talk a few days ago, I said that in looking at the Dharma, we shouldn't treat it as something outside that we're not doing, but rather see how am I already doing it? How's it already the case? And then seeing how it's already the case, how can I expand it and let that grow? So it's not something we import, but rather something we export. So, in that spirit, then I'll give you this very simple description of the Four Noble Truths. If you stop doing something that's harming you, the harm ends. Isn't that simple? Isn't that like pretty common sense? I mean, can you imagine one of these great world religions that's at the heart is what it is all about? You know, we probably lose our nonprofit status as a religion. So probably we should keep it kind of quiet. That's all it's about. Stop doing what's harming you. The harm ends. That's the Four Noble Truths. And what was you do that all the time. You have a splinter in your foot, and you're walking along with a splinter in your foot. You stop and you pull out the splinter. I mean, that's pretty ordinary, right? What the Buddha said is that there's a barb splinter in our hearts, and he discovered how to pull it out. What the Buddha discovered was how this very simple, ordinary thing that all human beings know how to do. When you stop something that's causing harm, the harm stops. People use that principle all the time. He learned how thoroughly and pervasive this can be applied into our life, how deep it can go into our hearts, into our depths of our being. So that this beautiful heart that we have can be healed, can be at peace, and can be of service for this world of ours. May you take the Four Noble Truths, which have always been your own. May you take that which has always been yours, and may it grow and cultivate you so that you and the Dharma become inseparable. You become the Dharma. Let's sit here for a little bit.